Amen. Well, as an immigrant to Canada and now a Canadian citizen, I'm often struck by how passionate Canadians get about political leaders of powerful nations that are associated with us. Sometimes we get more worked up about these other nations than we do about ourselves, especially those of long-standing relationships with Canada, and certainly those that insist that maybe they have some kind of a claim on us. And we get really upset when these nations are led by leaders who make what we consider to be stupid decisions. When they do things that we think are absolutely crazy. When they surround themselves with yes men and friends and people that won't argue with them and debate with them. And we get even more upset when that country starts talking about Canada and thinking about Canada and so on. We get really worked up when these leaders are doing those things. We begin to question their sanity and we wonder about the quality of their life and the stupidity of them looking of their judgment and the frustration we have because of the actions and the decisions that they are making. It consumes our coffee time and our meal conversations. I'm speaking, of course, about the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, who at this very time is fighting for his political life because of a judgment call he made in appointing Jeffrey Epstein supporter Peter Mandelson as ambassador to the United States. And all around, they're saying, who wants a leader that's got that lousy of a judgment and has friends who are such losers as that? Because the truth is, the people that we have around us and the people that we give authority to in our life and the people that we have that say, yeah, you know, they know me well, they would represent me well, it says something about us, doesn't it? And it certainly says something about Jesus. When we look at and we consider those that Jesus chose to have as his closest friends, when we think about the character of the people that he puts in charge of his kingdom when he leaves, because he chose people who would betray him, who would abandon him, and who would, in fact, deny him as a lost cause. People who, when the chips actually came down, ran away and might easily be categorized more as losers than leaders. I mean, this is quite a movement. Quite a kingdom that Jesus has set up. A king who chooses losers for leaders. What does that say about Jesus? You know, the passage that we're going to look at is so incredibly dense and it's so complex. I had a hard time in the last couple of weeks trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to say here? What is it, Lord, that you have for the people? There's so much in here. And I, you know, right until the middle of this last week, and though I've been working on it for a couple of weeks, I couldn't figure out, how does this go together? What am I going to say? So I finally went back. A little trick for you. I learned this in the first preaching class that I ever took back in Alberta Bible College when I was 18 years old. That was a long time ago. And it said, you know, when you're reading in the Gospels or any of the Old Testament, the narrative or the story books, if it gets jumbled for you, if you're trying to figure out, okay, what does this mean and how does it go? There's a little outline that you can use. And it's called the occasion, the event, and the outcome. And if you can describe those three things, oftentimes you can dig into what's at the center or the middle of that passage. The occasion has to do with the surrounding, what's going on around it, what's happening, what's the background, what's the story so far, well, how does the movie develop so far, as Ryan would say as he was standing up here. That's kind of the occasion, the background. The event is, what's the particular passage and the event or the thing that the person is doing right now? What is that in the middle of that occasion? How does that go together? And of course, the outcome is, what difference does it make? What's the difference that happened because the event took place? And because this passage is so difficult, so dense, so incredibly powerful, that's kind of the outline that we're going to go with. So, the occasion. Well, we kind of know the occasion. We've been working at it for the last year. It's the background of it, the movie so far. And we know that Jesus is in Jerusalem. And in these last few days of his life, he'd come and he'd confronted Israel, and in particular the temple, because they were fruitless. Remember the whole fig tree that looked like it was going to supply nourishment, looked like it was supposed to supply some good things. But when Jesus goes there, in fact, it's barren. It's empty. There's no nourishment. There's no food. And Jesus says to the people in the ruling the temple, you are like that. You are fruitless. You're supposed to give fruitfulness and nourishment to people, but instead, you're not only fruitless, but you've become like Pharaoh of old. And instead of nourishing people, you and these rituals and this religion you've set up are burdening them and extracting from them instead of carrying out God's course of being a blessing to all people and all nations as God called our father Abraham to do. You're just in it for yourself. And he told that story about the sheep and the goats and not looking after those who are downtrodden and looking after themselves. And he says, listen, don't you understand that the way you treat people, that is your religion. Especially those who are lower than you, who are powerless, who don't have the authority of you, who don't have the status of you, who don't have the abilities of you. How you treat those folks, that's what you really believe. And that is who you really are. That is your heart. That is your character. And you guys, who are supposed to be leaders of God's people, just care about yourself. And your heart judges you. And then, right after that, as we saw Ryan last week, it's sort of the other side of the coin. The story of the woman we sang about in that song who comes and pours out her life's giving, her life savings, her very life source of on Jesus, the most possessive, most precious possession she had. She breaks it open, pours it all out in an act of love for Jesus. Because you see, she had experienced the love of Jesus. And when we truly experience the love of Jesus, and the love of Jesus takes over our hearts, then we can spread that love to other people and into God himself. Because as Ryan said, the deeds of the kingdom have to be joined to the devotion of the king. If those things don't go together, if all of a sudden we're trying to do the deeds of the kingdom without this love of Christ flowing in, and without us therefore being able to love Jesus back because we understand and experience the love of God, then we're in great danger of disillusionment and anger and even hatred, which is what we saw Judas doing at the end of the passage last week. So that's sort of what's going on, and we're into the final hours of Jesus' life now. And it's at that point that we pick things up in chapter 26, verse 17. On the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Where do you want us to make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" And Jesus replied, "Go into the city to a certain man and tell him, 'The teacher says, my appointed time is near. I'm going to celebrate the Passover with my disciples at your house.' So the disciples did as Jesus directed them, and they prepared the Passover meal." Man, the Passover. It's almost impossible to overstate how important the Passover was and is to the Jewish people. And there is so much depth and there is so much interest. I mean, we could spend hours talking about all of that, but let me try and strip it down to the essentials for what we need today to learn about this event that's about to take place. As Joanne said, the Passover meal, or the Seder, kicked off the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. That feast lasted a week. It was one of the great feasts that all of the people, one of the traveling feasts, all people, Jews from all over the world, would come into Jerusalem at Passover. They say that, you know, there was probably like about 100,000 extra people would come into a city of about 50,000. So you can imagine how much it goes. And this whole event celebrated and brought to mind how God rescued his people. Now, here's an important thing for you guys. The Passover meal was not just something, as Peterson warned us about it, just something that we look back and became a ritual. For the Jewish people, when they participated in the Passover meal, what they were doing is actually participating in the event of the Exodus. They were actually becoming and saying, we are this people that God delivered out of Egypt. That's who I am. It formed their identity. When all of the other nations had all of these other gods and all of the Romans said that you're just slaves and all of these different things, what the Passover meal did is said, no, I'm participating in this story. This is my identity. I belong to the one who delivered us from slavery. I am free. I am God's. I'm participating in this. I'm not just remembering it. I am actually becoming it. I'm becoming the people who had been held in slavery for 400 years. I'm the people that God sent Moses to deliver when he sent the 10 plagues, and he sent that final plague, the death of the firstborn, where he said, if you don't have the blood of the Lamb on your doorpost, I'm going to send an angel of death, and the firstborn of your family, your livestock, your everything will die. And anyone, Jew or Egyptian or foreigner alike, if you will have this blood of the Lamb over your doorpost, then the angel of death will pass over you and your family will live. That's the great event as God led his people out of these years and years and centuries of slavery. And then God said, I'm going to institute a meal. And it's a meal that you're going to take of every year, not just to remember those things, but to actually participate, to actually become the woman and the man and the child that God has delivered. And this meal had a very highly structured, it kind of changed over the centuries, but it was structured by participating in four cups or four drinks of wine. And as they would partake in each of these cups, a little bit of the story of God rescuing his people would be told. Now, it got quite complex, but you know, Gamaliel, you know, we all know Rabbi Gamaliel, right? Because he's the teacher of the Apostle Paul. And he said, listen, if you want to boil the Passover down to the essential elements, we've got the structure, but what are the three things that need to be in there in order for you to say, yes, I've done the Passover? And the three things were, first of all, the unleavened bread. Because unleavened bread symbolized the haste of the Exodus. How they didn't have time to wait for the bread to have yeast in it to rise. No, we're going to eat it right away because God's deliverance is going to be quick and unexpected in some ways, at least to the Egyptians, and fast. And you have to have bitter herbs, or herbs, as some people would say. But in England, it's herbs. And then he said that recalls the bitterness of slavery. Think like horseradish, street horseradish. And it says, as bitter as that is, that reminds us how bitter it is to be enslaved and not to be free. And then, of course, there was the Passover lamb, the blood of the lamb, which symbolized deliverance through sacrifice, which talked about protection from the enemy by the blood and the redemption or the buying back of slavery. Of course, in Jesus' meal, there was no lamb. Because you see, he said when the evening fell, he started to do it. You need to remember about the Jewish calendars. Our days kind of start at midnight, right? They began at sunset. And so he has in this meal, this Passover feast early. And the lambs had not yet been slaughtered. Those perfect one-year-old spotless lambs would be slaughtered on later on in the day. But they didn't need to have that lamb slaughtered, because Jesus himself was going to be the Passover lamb, the lamb whose blood was shed. And so Jesus gathers around, and this is the surrounding of it. This is the occasion. It's Passover, and they're going to go through this meal. And what we need to understand is everybody understood exactly how this meal would go. They've been celebrating it now for 1,000 years, every year of their life. And right from they were children on, they knew the words. They knew what came next. They knew what it was to participate. And they were going into this meal with this anticipation. Well, then, through that, in that context, that's the occasion. What about the event? Let's pick it up, verse 20. When the evening came, Jesus was reclining at the table with the 12. And while they were eating, he said, "Truly, I tell you, one of you will betray me." And they were all very sad and began to say to him, one after the other, "Surely, you don't mean me, Lord." Jesus would reply, "The one who has dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me. The Son of Man will go just as it is written about him. But woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born." Then Judas, the one who would betray him, said, "Surely you don't mean me, Rabbi." And Jesus answered, "You've said so." While they were eating, Jesus took the bread, this unleavened bread, this bread which was symbolizing the haste and the difficulty. And when he'd given thanks, he broke it and he gave it to his disciples. And then he flips the script. He does something which they never would expect. He says, "This, take and eat, because this is my body." And then he took the cup, and when he'd given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until the day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom." And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus told them, "This very night," which do you want? Then Jesus told them, "This very night you will fall away on account of me. For it's written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I've risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." Peter replied, "Even if all fall away on account of you, I never will." "Truly, I tell you," Jesus answered, "this very night, before the rooster crows, you will disown me 3 times. But Peter declared, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." And all of the other disciples said the same thing. So what does Jesus do in this event? He does 2 main things. The first thing he does is he predicts the failure of the people he'd chosen to be closest to him. And the second thing he did was that he completely reinterpreted the Passover and gave it its fullness of meaning. So let's take a look at that. First of all, this whole thing about his prediction of the failure. You know, the mood of the Passover, it was serious because, you know, the story of Israel and God intervening, and all those, it was a very serious meal, but it was a joyful meal. It was a meal full of laughter. It was a meal full of celebration. It was a meal full of, yeah, things are good. God has done this. And it's a meal full of hope. And in the midst of this, as they're chatting and laughing and visiting, Jesus drops this bomb. "Oh, by the way, one of you who's closest to me, one of you who dips your hand in the food to get this food in the bread, one of you who's closest to me is going to betray me. You're going to turn me over to the enemies, and I'm going to be killed. You're going to work against me, and you're going to bring upon me shame and ridicule and even death." You know, we do that. Oh, we don't turn Jesus over to Rome. But many of us have participated in making Jesus the object of ridicule at some point in our life. Many of us have gone through a phase in life where we dismiss him and his work as nothing. And we put aside his kingdom, his people, as a joke. Or at best unimportant, and at worst maybe even destructive to lives and society. You know, the interesting thing about this event that happens, the disciples, they don't come off too well in this story. But in one way, they do come off well in this story. Because they didn't all turn to the other guy and say, well, hey, this is Judas, or hey, this is Peter. Or No. They recognized and understood and realized that it could be them. And they said to Jesus, you know, this word of betrayal, it's horrendous. I can't imagine. Myself. Surely you don't mean that I would in some way betray you, Jesus. They asked the question of themselves. They were honest about their own sense of weakness and the ability that we have to betray the one that we love. I love what Tom Wright says about this in this passage. He says this, "Surely you don't mean me, Lord. Only when you've said that, knowing that it might well be you, only then can we begin to appreciate what it meant for Jesus to sit at that table and to share the Passover meal with them. And with Judas too." We only get the significance of the table. We only get the significance of this table when we begin to really understand that Jesus knows that there are times when I will betray him. And in spite of that, in fact, even because of that, Jesus invites us to this table and everything that it means. He says, some of you, perhaps all of you in some way, are going to betray me. All of you for sure. Says verse 31, all of you are going to abandon me. You know, what's really interesting about this word abandon is the word actually means to stumble. All of you will stumble because of me. It's the whole idea of you're walking along. You know how it goes. You're walking along and then this pathway and you trip on a stone and you sort of stumble off in a direction that's different than the way in which you were going. And Jesus says, this is going to happen to every single one of you. You're going to be walking along with me, and then something about me is going to cause you to stumble, and you're going to go off track. You're going to abandon me. You're going to flee me. What's interesting is that he says, you're going to stumble on account of me. You know, oftentimes when I read the gospel stories, what we're going to see just in next week is that the arrest of Jesus, and everybody does flee, everybody runs away. And you know, when I read that passage, I don't know about you, but I think it, I always was thinking it's because, yeah, they're scared of their life, because they don't want to die, because they don't want to get arrested, because of all those things. But Jesus doesn't say that. It's quite interesting. What Jesus says is, you're going to stumble, you're going to get off track because of me. Not because you fear for your life, not because you've got this enemy in front of me, but because of me. Because what Jesus understood is that when he enacted the very heart of his mission, of handing himself over to be killed, of submitting himself to a tyrannical ruler and a perverse religion, when he did that, that the disciples couldn't handle. The disciples could have handled drawing their swords and cutting off more than an ear. The disciples could have handled standing against them and fighting against with all of their strength and their power. They couldn't handle Jesus loving his enemies and being willing to die for them. They were still not ready, even after all of this time, for the upside-down kingdom that Jesus was doing. And so they stumbled because of what the gospel really is. And they said, this just isn't going to work. Man, I stumble because of Jesus. I get off track because of what the gospel really is. I run away from the plan. This forgiveness stuff, it's just too hard. And man, if you knew what that person really did to me, you'd understand why I just can't forgive them. Nobody could forgive them that. This serving stuff, it's just too unrewarded and unappreciated. I'm tired of it. This transforming relationships through grace and through love, it just takes too long. I've been pouring grace out for too long. I just give up. Forget it. It's too toxic. I'm out. No more grace for them. I tried laying down my life for that person, and they just walked right over top of it. When the gospel really comes down to the nitty and the gritty of life, I can stumble. I can say, surely it doesn't mean that. Surely I got to keep some power. Surely I got to get aggressive sometimes in some way and fight back. Surely enough is enough at some point. And I stumble, just as they stumbled, and get off the track and fall away. Peter, he was a strong guy. He was a determined guy, and he didn't believe that of himself. He says, listen, it could be that the rest of these guys, they might stumble, not me, Jesus. I am going to stick with you. I will die for you. And Jesus says, Oh, Peter, who is so strong. Peter, who is the rock. Peter, you're going to deny me 3 times. Before the day's done. And some of us have denied Christ in all kinds of ways, maybe most of us. We've been silenced when we should have spoken out. Sometimes we've spoken words that should have remained silent. Some of us have separated Jesus from our work life. We'd underpaid workers, or we've slacked off on the job, or we haven't quite been honest come income tax time. Some of us have hidden our allegiance to Jesus to fit into some social circle to which we aspire. Some of us, even as followers of Jesus, have done things and people have turned to us and said, you're a Christian? Man, I remember, I'm going to get worked up here. It's rough when you get to be an old man. Your male hormones drop. I remember when Andrew was in grade school. And you know, in behind what is now Home Hardware on 100th Street? So if you go in behind, there's a bunch of alleys that you can cut through, right? And if you know it, there's one of them, it's a one-way alley. Do you know what I'm talking about? Have you been back there? And Andrew was in grade school, and it was way shorter to go that through that alley. And so I started to go the wrong way down that alley. And Andrew said, so he's old enough to realize, he says, Dad, that said it's a one-way street. To which I said, that's for everybody else, son. And I remember the look of disappointment on his face. Because I'm a follower of Jesus. And I had denied him in the face of my son. The thing about Jesus is, he knew this about his disciples when he gathered them around for the meal, before that, when he gathered them at first. He knew that about his disciples. He knows that about me, that I'll betray, abandon, deny, subtle little ways. He knew that about me, and he knows that about you. And it's because of who we are. And it's because of what we do or what we don't do. And because Jesus knows this, that he did what causes the Passover to be reinterpreted. He gives his life so that we could be his intimate ones, his friends, his leaders, his kingdom advancers who bring heaven to earth. And he gives this incredible new interpretation of the Passover. You know, in the words of the Passover, when they took bread, there's these great words that were said. I think it's going to be on the screen here, that the guy, the leader who's leading Passover, would put up, I hope. It's an incredible thing. They would say of this unleavened bread, this is the bread of affliction, which our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. Look at this. Look at this. Let everyone who hungers come and eat. Let everyone who is needy come and eat the Passover meal. This is the qualification to come to the table. To come to the table. To be hungry for spiritual life. To recognize that we are needy, that we have sin in our life, that we are broken, that our relationships are broken, that we have betrayed, abandoned, and denied Jesus, that we have abandoned the cause to which we are supposed to be leaders. That's the qualification, to recognize the need, to come broken and needy and humble. And Jesus said, listen, this is my body. So come now and bring your afflictions. Bring those things, those circumstances which are hurting you. Bring your pain and your sorrow which causes you to weep in the silence of the darkness of night. Bring your fears that you've got circumstances and relationships and difficulties that lay ahead of you this week and you don't know how you're going to handle it and you're afraid of it, you're afraid you might stumble, you're afraid it might go wrong. Bring those fears, bring your hunger and your need for spiritual life because you know that you are not who you're supposed to be, who you even want to be, and you need that spiritual food and sustenance. Come and eat and get nourished from the body of Christ. The qualification is just to recognize your need and willingness to come to Jesus. And then Jesus took the cup. And he said, I know you're used to the blood of the Lamb, which caused death to pass over, which rescued you and was the deliverance and all of those things. But now I want you to understand that this is my blood of the covenant. That it's now my blood that causes death to pass over you, that protects you from the enemy of death. It's my blood which washes away your sin. It's my blood that says that this is a covenant meal, that when we partake of this cup because of the pouring out of Jesus, when I partake of this cup, when I drink of this, you are my God. And I am your son. And that is a promise and a covenant that though I will break, you will never break. You will never be faithless. You will never betray or abandon or deny me as I put my trust in you. I thank God that every single week, I know that this week, probably even this day, I've betrayed, abandoned, or denied Jesus in act or in action, in word or in deed, in thought or in attitude. And every week, Jesus stands at this table. He says, listen, come to me with your affliction. Come to me with your fear. Come to me with your failure. Because that's why I shed my blood. And the only qualification is that you recognize your need. And you can come and get sustenance from the bread of affliction. From a God who understands, who knew you were going to mess it up. And the blood of the covenant, which says your identity is changed, Alan. When you participate in this meal, you participate. You're not just remembering that I shed my blood for you. You are participating in that shed blood. And I'm saying to you that you are my son in spite of your failure. And my blood has washed away your sin. And every week, and more if I want,
I can come to this table. Because Jesus sort of reinterpreted or fulfilled the Passover.
I love how the Bible Project guys put it. They said this, through the Lamb, Yahweh rescued the Israelites from slavery to Pharaoh. And through Jesus, Yahweh God rescues the world from slavery to sin and death.
That's the event. That's what Jesus was doing in this incredible context of this movie that we've been following along. So what's the outcome? What's the result?
Well, Jesus tells us in verse 29, the kingdom has come in Christ, not yet in its fulfillment, but in its beginning. He said, my death is not the end. I'm going to drink with this you again. Because of my death, the kingdom is coming. You know, it's interesting that the Jews believed that the Exodus, this escape from Egypt, they believed and understood that there's going to be another Exodus, that there's going to be another rescue, that there's going to be another deliverance, and that this time God would forgive not only the sins of Israel, but the sins of the whole world, and that God himself would destroy the great slave master, sin and death in our lives. And Jesus was saying, not just by the words he spoke, but by the act that he partake, this is my body, this is my blood. He was saying that this time of expectation, this time of hope is now yours to grasp. It has come fulfilled in my life. And your hope can be fulfilled. And your sin can be forgiven. And your identity can be changed. You see, that's the great news of the outcome. That losers like me are invited. That those of us who've betrayed Christ are invited. That those of us who stumble because this gospel way doesn't make any sense when we're trying to live real life. And those of us who in subtle ways have denied Jesus and his people are invited. To invite to recognize that our failure is real, but it's not finished. That the disciples failed, I failed. Leaders of the kingdom fail. Leaders of the church fail. You fail. We're in so much as a failure all together in this whole mess, except for Jesus who does not fail. And Jesus invites us, come and eat and drink and be mine. And remember who you are because of what I have done. Come, you loser Alan. You betrayer, you denier, you abandoner. Come and be close to me. Come and lead the charge of my kingdom against the darkness that rules the world. And what does that say about Jesus and his judgment of people? We judge other leaders by the people that they have around them and the decisions that they make, and politicians lose their position because of their choices. What does it say about this Jesus that he chooses us? That he chooses betrayers, abandoners, stumblers, deniers. It says that he is a king like no other, ruling a kingdom that is like no other. It says that he's a king who's looking for people not who are rocks and full of self-confidence, but people who have humble awareness of their need. It says that he's a king who's calling people not who are impressive performers, but honest, repentant failures. It says that he's a king who gives you and me a new identity, not an identity of those that our parents told us, the world told us, our social spheres tell us, Instagram tells us, not that identity, but an identity that says you are a child of God Almighty, in covenant with him, transformed into queens and kings for his kingdom. It says that he is a king who sheds his own blood to rescue sinners from the tyranny of the sins that trap us and eat us alive. It says that he is a king who chooses losers as friends and as leaders. It says that he is a king who is worthy of our worship. Almighty God, how upside down is your kingdom? How strange is this story? How nonsensical it is if it wasn't true. It's so opposite to what in my natural self that I think and act. You are this great God who says each week, this is the bread of affliction. Come and bring your worry, bring your fears, bring your failures, bring your sorrow. Bring your life that's become bitter and have life. Come and drink of my blood. Which protects you from sin and death. It gives you new life. Come and drink of this blood of the covenant which says that I am yours and you are mine. And I will never forsake you nor leave you, even though you do me. Come to me. Just come to me. Not as people who are perfect. Not as people who are performers. But as people who just say, is it me? Is it me that betrays? Is it me that abandons? Is it me that denies? Oh God, it is me. And I am so thankful that I'm exactly the person you came to die and to live for. And so we come to you and we claim these promises. And we live in this new identity. And we have courage that your kingdom has begun. Your kingdom is coming. Your kingdom will come to fulfillment. And we are part of that because of who you say I am. Because of who Jesus is. You have made me. O King Jesus, how we worship you.